The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm honored to be here this evening to introduce Daniel Bergner. A master storyteller and immersive researcher, Daniel Bergner is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. His three previous nonfiction books cover territory as diverse as war-torn Sierra Leone, to a prison rodeo at Louisiana's notorious Angola prison, to the inner landscapes of unusual erotic desires. His new book, What Do Women Want? Or What Do Women Want? I've been pronouncing it differently all week. Delves into the science of, as he says, the drives that lie concealed beneath the surface, that crouch within the strictures of female desire. Full of meticulously detailed research and vivid anecdotal narrative, it promises to give both men and women a better understanding of just what it is that motivates and stimulates female desire and sexuality. Ladies and gentlemen, won't you please join me in welcoming Daniel Bergner.
Well, thank you all for coming out tonight. I'm going to read a bit, but I just thought I'd say a little bit about my writing life. I sometimes think we all, when it comes to sex, at least live at least a couple of lives. I, as a writer, certainly have over the last decade or so. Part of my life has been spent writing about sex and desire. I've written a book before this, The Other Side of Desire, and then this book. But I also spend a lot of my time writing about economic development and war, often in Africa. And that's kind of hard to reconcile sometimes, kind of hard to explain to myself, let alone explain to others. And it's particularly hard to explain, I think, when I'm on one of those stories or writing one of those books about economic development in the third world. So conversations sometimes go like this. What else are you working on? And I'll say, well, I'm working on this book about female desire called What Do Women Want? And a very serious economist will look back at me with discomfort, dismay, wondering, what am I, a serious economist, doing talking to this weirdo who's writing a book called What Do Women Want? Not so long ago, had that look from Jeffrey Sachs. But fortunately, this spring, my two lives came together. I was working on a story about economic development in Sierra Leone, where I've spent lots and lots of time. And I was out way at the Liberian border, climbing around in these tunnels, these gold mining tunnels, and then was driving back with Mustafa, Sierra Leonean logistics officer for the gold mining company. And we were on this long, endless, really cratered road, and off in the distance saw a woman walking alone, draped in these elegant yellow and blue fabrics. And now Mustafa and I had had the conversation, what else are you working on? And in fact, in his case, it had resulted in quite a raucous talk. And he said, now seeing this woman in the distance, he said, you must come down. And in Sierra Leone patois, that means get out of the vehicle. You must come down, Daniel, and talk to this woman. So I did. And it turned out she is on a sort of perpetual circuit, 1,500 miles each way from her home country, Niger, to Sierra Leone, selling the remedies, the medications, the homespun remedies of her country, Niger. And she had two products that were relevant to me. The first was one that provided manpower, and that, as you might expect, is herbal Viagra. And the other, she said, if you rub this on, and she showed me exactly how to do it, so it was kind of powder on the neck and lower face, if you rub this on, the woman will love you. And despite our slight language barrier, it was clear that she meant love in a very, very, very lusty way. And so I bought this medication. It's here. It didn't come in the Duane Reade pill jar, but came, she had this kind of discarded blue plastic bag, so she tore off a scrap, she wraps it up. There's the pinch of powder. It is the answer to the question posed here. You can, if you want to buy a pinch from me, then walk out of the auditorium. You need not hear any of this ambivalent reasoning. It's all here. It comes at a very steep price due to transport cost. But you will be supporting the development of the economic axis of Niger and Sierra Leone. So to be considered, just raise your hand. But in a more, in a more complex way, I've spent the last 8 years now talking to scientists, most of them women, and to individual women about their sexual lives, lives I thread through the book. And so I want to just start by reading a tiny bit from the beginning of the book. This begins with my meeting Meredith Chivers, who kind of started this journey for me. And here we are. It needs no introduction because it is the introduction. So it's the first few pages of chapter one, which is called Animals. On the subject of women and sex, Meredith Chivers was out to obliterate the civilized world. The social conventions, the lists of sins, all the intangible influences needed to go. I've spent a lot of time, she said, attempting to get back in my head to what life was like for proto-humans. When Chivers and I first met 7 years ago, she was in her mid-30s. She wore high-heeled black boots that laced up almost to her knees and skinny, stylish, rectangular glasses. Her blonde hair fell over a scoop-neck black top. She was a young but distinguished scientist in a discipline whose name, sexology, sounds something like a joke, a mismatching of prefix and suffix of the base and the erudite. Yet the matching is in earnest. The ambitions of the field have always been grand. And Chivers' dreams were no different. She hoped to peer into the workings of the psyche, to see somehow past the consequences of culture, of nurture, of all that is learned, and to apprehend a piece of women's primal and essential selves, a fundamental set of sexual truths that exist inherently at the core. Men are animals. On matters of Eros, we accept this as a kind of psychological axiom. Men are tamed by society, kept, for the most part, between boundaries, yet the subduing isn't so complete as to hide their natural state, which announces itself in endless ways, through pornography, through promiscuity, through an infinity of gazes directed at infinite passing bodies of desire, and which is affirmed by countless lessons of popular science. That men's minds are easily commandeered by the lower, less advanced neural regions of the brain, that men are programmed by evolutionary forces to be pitched inescapably into lust by the sight of certain physical qualities or proportions, like the 0.7 waist-to-hip ratio in women that seems to inflame heterosexual males all over the globe, from America to Guinea-Bissau, that men are mandated again by the dictates of evolution to increase the odds that their genes will survive in perpetuity, and hence that they are compelled to spread their seed to crave as many 0.7s as possible. But why don't we say that women, too, are animals? Chivers was trying to discover animal realities. She carried out her research in a series of cities, in Evanston, Illinois, which sits right next to Chicago, in Toronto, and most recently in Kingston, Ontario, which feels utterly on its own, tiny and fragile. The Kingston Airport is barely more than a hangar. Kingston's pale stone architecture has a thick, appealing solidity, yet it doesn't chase away the sense that the little downtown area on the frigid spot where Lake Ontario spills into the St. Lawrence River isn't much more formidable than when it was founded as a French fur trading post in the 17th century. Kingston is the home of Queen's University, a sprawling institution of learning where Chivers was a psychology professor. But the city is stark and scant enough that it is easy to imagine an earlier emptiness, the buildings gone, the pavement gone, almost nothing there except evergreens and snow. And this seemed fitting to me when I visited her. Because to reach the insight she wanted, she needed to do more than strip away societal codes. She needed to get rid of all the streets, all the physical as well as the incorporeal structures that have their effects on the conscious and the unconscious. She needed to create some pure, primordial situation so that she could declare, "This is what lies at the heart of women's sexuality." Plainly, she wasn't going to be able to establish such conditions for her studies. Almost surely, for that matter, such pure conditions never existed because proto-humans, our forehead-deficient ancestors of some hundreds of thousands of years ago, had proto-cultures. But what she possessed was a plethysmograph, a miniature bulb and light sensor that you place inside the vagina. This is what her female subjects did as they sat on a brown leatherette lazy boy chair in her small, dimly lit lab in Toronto. Semi-reclining on the lazy boy, each subject watched an array of porn on an old, bulky computer monitor. The 2-inch-long glassine tube of the plethysmograph beams light against the vaginal walls and reads the illumination that bounces back. It measures blood flow. It was a way to get past the obfuscations of the mind, the interference of the brain's repressive upper regions. As they enrolled in the study, Chivers' subjects had identified themselves as straight or lesbian. This is what all of them saw. So, it being a library, I'm going to move slightly away from what they actually saw, but I will describe it. I will encapsulate it and then leave you in the privacy of your own homes to read the pornography described. So anyway, she showed truly an array of pornography. So it was men and men, men and women, women alone, men alone, whatever permutations I've just forgotten about, and then bonobos, a species of ape, having sex. And she showed this to self-identified straight and gay men and women. And she measured not only genital, physical response, but also gave each subject a keypad on which they could rate their own sense of being turned on. So here's, there were a series of interesting things that we can circle back to in discussion, but one thing worth noting now is that for men, the keypad responses, the self-rating, and the physical responses matched up quite well and were very predictable. So self-identified straight men, you know, if there was a woman in the scene, great, their self-rating and their bodily rating all leaping up and they're and all matching up, right? And same for gay men. And interestingly enough, like you'd think, okay, men kind of primitive, those bonobos kind of hot in their sort of base way, the men would be feeling something, but no, I mean, it was just like nothing, just flatline. Now, flip over to the women. So let's work backwards. So first of all, the bonobos did like do something there, at least on the physical readings. And interestingly, the physical and the subjective readings, so the objective and subjective, did not match up at all. So women said they felt nothing for the bonobos. Their bodies said they did feel something for the bonobos. The straight women said they were really only turned on by scenes with men in them. No, actually, the scenes with women alone did just fine. In fact, again, something to circle back to, it was only the man, of all those permutations, only the man alone, and it seems for a very particular reason, don't let me forget to get back to this later, that he did nothing. But all the other scenes were terrifically a turn on, at least physically, for both the straight and gay women. And again, there was this always gap between the subjective and objective reading. So one of the reasons I just wanted to stay with this, having stumbled into Meredith's lab, was just this in itself was fascinating. And she was on this fascinating journey on all kinds of levels. One of those levels was the attempt, you know, as I've alluded to in these pages, to get past culture, past nurture, to something more essential. And of course, that's a quixotic effort, right? We know we can't get beyond the nature-nurture debate. And, you know, as a writer, I love quixotic efforts. I mean, we're all involved. We're living. We are involved in a quixotic effort. And here it was kind of writ large. Here was Meredith trying to parse these elements at the center of our psyche. So I could not leave that, wanted to stay there, then branched out to other researchers and to talking to lots and lots of other women, and then sort of narrowing down those lots and lots to a handful who I got to know so well that I felt like I could tell their stories in an accurate and intimate way. But though the book is about 90% women, I did take a detour to look at our close primate ancestors and what they might have to teach us. So I spent a week at probably the most prominent primatology center in the States and wanted to look at, through, you know, our next of kin going backward in evolutionary terms, wanted to look at a kind of standard paradigm that we've all absorbed, which is the evolutionary psychology model that says men are genetically programmed to spread their seed and thus to be promiscuous, while women, at least by comparison, at least relatively speaking, sexually driven to seek out one good man and thus to be at least relatively well suited to monogamy. And so here is, here's one of my favorite characters in the book. Her unruly red blonde hair tufting atop her head, Deidre sat beside Oppenheimer. She lipped his ear. She mouthed his chest. She kissed his belly over and over, lips lingering with each kiss. After a while, he pulled himself up and strolled away from her attentions, glancing back over his shoulder to see if she was following. She was. Deidre, who was probably the most reserved female monkey in the compound, started in again on his white-haired torso as they sat together on a concrete curb. The habitat was filled with ladders and ropes and assorted apparatus donated by a local fire department and by McDonald's. An environment of trees and vines would have been too expensive to create and maintain. A trio of monkey children sprinted toward a tube, disappeared inside it, burst from the other end, and raced around for another run-through, berserk with joy. From a platform on a steel tower, I watched with Kim Wallen, his beard silver, his eyes alight. A psychologist and neuroendocrinologist, he spent much of his time here at Yerkes, an Emory University research center outside Atlanta that was home to 2,000 primates. We gazed down at the habitat 75 rhesus, a monkey species that had been sent into orbit in spaceships in the 50s and 60s as stand-ins for humans to see if we would survive trips to the moon. Wallen had lived on a farm as a child when his father, a psychologist, decided to try out a utopian dream of cooperative goat rearing. Wallen's observation of animal sexuality had begun then. He'd been watching monkeys now for decades. Females were passive, he said. That was the theory in the middle 70s. That was the wisdom. He remembered the start of his career. Deidre's face, always a bit redder than most, was luminous this morning, lit scarlet with lust as she lifted it from Oppenheimer's chest. The prevailing model, he said, was that female hormones affected female pheromones, affected the female's smell, her attractivity to the male. The male initiated all sexual behavior. What science had managed to miss in the monkeys, what it had effectively erased, was female desire. And it had missed more than that. In this breed used as our astronaut doubles, females are the bullies and murderers, the generals in brutal warfare, the governors. This had been noted in journal articles back in the 30s and 40s, but thereafter it had gone unrecognized, the articles buried and the behavior oddly unperceived. It so flew in the face of prevailing ideas about the dominant role of males, Wallen said, that it was just ignored. And to a large extent still is. What mostly male scientists had expected and likely wanted to see appeared to have blinded them. Wallen's career had been about pulling back the blinders. At the moment, below us, one female clawed fiercely at another, bit into a leg, whipped the weaker one back and forth like a weightless doll. Harrowing shrieks rose up. Four or five more monkeys joined in, attacking the one who escaped somehow, sped away, was caught again. The shrieks grew more plaintive, more piercing, the attackers piling on, apparently for the kill, then desisting inexplicably. Assaults like this flared often. Wallen and his team usually couldn't glean the reasons. Full battle, one female-led family's attempt to overthrow another, was rare. That tended toward death, from wounds, from sheer fright and shock. Occasionally, the compound was littered with corpses. When he thought about the way science had somehow kept itself oblivious to female monkey lust for so long, Wallen blamed not only preconceptions, but the sex act itself. When you look at the sexual interaction, he said, it's easy to see what the male is doing. He's thrusting. It takes really focusing on the entire interaction to see all that the female is doing, and once you truly see it, you can never overlook it again. Deidre fingered Oppenheimer's belly, caressing, desperate to win his favors. He flopped down on his front, inert in a strip of sun. She kissed where she could get access, his ear again. The red of her face bordered on neon. Bulky and torpid, Oppenheimer and the habitat's other adult male didn't fully take part in the life of the compound. They didn't belong to any particular family. They were merely breeders, and their peripheral status mimicked the male role in the wild. There, in Asian mountains or lowland forests, adult males lurked at the edges of female-run domains. The females invited them in to serve sexually. The males remained desirable, dispensable, until the females lost interest in them. Then they were dismissed, replaced. In his compounds, Wallen removed the breeders and introduced new males about every 3 years, the time it took for them to become irrelevant, for their charms to wane, for the frequency of their copulations, almost always female-initiated, to fade. In the wild, they seemed to stay attractive only slightly longer. Rhesus females are very xenophobic when it comes to other females, Wallen said. Introduce a new female into the compound and she'll be hounded until she dies. But when it comes to males, females have a bias toward novelty. With his pale muzzle and russet back, Oppenheimer loped off once more and Deidre trailed him. A child of hers, less than a year old, hurried behind her. Wallen's assistants adored Deidre. They loved her sprigs of out-of-control hair. They loved her personality, the quiet dignity she emanated most of the time, if not at the moment, and they loved the devotion of her mothering. Last year, upheaval in the compound had left her and her children vulnerable. Horribly frightened, they latched onto her and wouldn't let go. Literally, Amy Henry, an assistant, said she could barely get up and walk without being dragged down by our kids. One held on to her tail. They wouldn't let her go. She accepted it all with grace. She knew it was her responsibility to reassure them that it was okay. She's always been a low-key monkey. But she gets very excited when she gives birth, and she gets very attached. I watched her carry her daughter on her back for a long time, right up to when she had a new baby. Not all moms will do that. With hustling after Oppenheimer on our mind, though, maternal instinct was gone. She didn't seem to see, let alone know, her baby. She kept leaving it alone, and it kept having to scoot after her. She positioned herself in front of Oppenheimer, crouched, and tapped a hand on the ground in a staccato rhythm. She tapped like this persistently, the rhesus equivalent of unbuckling a man's belt. Yet her gesture contained a touch of hesitance. "She's being careful," Wallen said, "because all the females around her are higher ranked. If they decided, for any reason, that they didn't want her having sex with him, they and their families might tear and bite her to death." All right, I got to find the monkey porn to make up for the last omission. Okay. At last, this is after a lot more stalking. At last, with Deidre tapping her crazed Morse code on the dirt, Oppenheimer reached out. Standing behind her, he set his hands on her hips. And suddenly she had what she wanted, his swift thrusts. He pumped back and forth in a flurry. Then he paused, pulled out briefly, touched her flanks, and slid inside her again for another bout of thrusting. He humped and pulled out repeatedly. When he came, thighs quivering and eyes going fuzzy, she twisted, turned her face to his, smacked her lips at high speed, reached back to seize him, and yanked him violently forward. Her fulfillment was short-lived. Within minutes, she was hounding him again. At other moments, she might have moved on to the other male. "She has sex," Wallen said about rhesus females on the whole. "And when he goes into his post-ejaculatory snooze, what does she do? She immediately gets up and goes off and finds another." Tracking the action of the compound, he asked himself, as he had so many times, whether libido in women has similar drive and whether, he said, because of social conventions and imperatives, women frequently don't act on or even recognize the intensity of motivation that monkeys obey. He answered, "I feel confident that this is true." So one last little bit of a conversation I had with a scientist, and then I'd love to have a conversation with you. I spent a lot of time thinking about this obscure but important book, the DSM, which is this psychiatric profession's kind of Bible of diagnosis, and thus it's Bible of normalcy, of what's healthy and of what's within the bounds, in a way, of normal. And about every 15 years, the volume gets revised, and this time around, and the new volume just came out last month, this time around there was a lot of debate about the sexuality chapter, and particularly about the section of that chapter that would deal with desire, which in turn is primarily about women's desire. And an interesting thing has happened over the last 30 years or so. So 30 years ago, if you'd asked people who were thinking about this, psychiatrists who were involved in this, to sort of diagram or conceptualize women's desire, it would have looked just like male desire. It would have been a simple arrow. It would have couldn't be more direct. So here's no desire, here's the arrow, desire, and it's just like that. It's a drive, a fundamental drive. Over the last 30 years, it's gone for women in this conceptualization from fundamental raw drive to complex emotion, and now to a completely different diagram and idea. So the diagram has gone from a line, arrow, to circle. There are all kinds of reasons for that, some aesthetic, some political. Again, we can talk about it, but you know, you can let's just go for the sort of simplest aesthetic dissection of that. I mean, this, if I could draw it here, and you can imagine, looks phallic and male and perhaps patriarchal, and this looks groovier and more in touch with the moon and all that. And I don't mean to be flip, but it is something profound and to me really troubling has happened along with the introduction of this circle, which is that women's desire in the psychiatric profession has been more and more conceptualized as something receptive, as something passive, as something you wait for, not as a raw drive. And in fact, the language that the DSM has adopted betrays this in a subtle but really telling way. So no longer is desire, even in the name of the disorder that thus in mirror image defines normal. So the disorder used to be hypoactive sexual desire disorder, low desire. Now desire has been stricken and substituted in its place is the word interest. So we no longer have heat. We don't have drive. We don't have desire. We have interest, which seems to me awfully kind of wan. And I don't know. We'll talk about that. But that I don't think that's right. But the woman in charge of this committee and I have had a sort of 6-year ongoing conversation, and I really respect her. She's a great thinker. She too is an inventive researcher like Meredith Shivers and also a therapist and deals with lots of couples and lots of women who come to her with low desire. And she and I talked a lot from all kinds of directions. But one of them, of course, was about monogamy and whether monogamy itself was a problem, in which case, for women, perhaps particularly, despite the old evolutionary psychology paradigm, and if monogamy is the problem or a big part of the problem, what does that say about having a disorder that's supposed to be a psychiatric disorder and so all about in here when it's really about that relationship and basically often just about how long it's lasted. So I just wanted to read you just a little bit of our conversation. I asked her about an irony within her DSM work that while disorders were supposed to be abnormal, HSDD seemed to be a normal abnormality, a condition that was largely not psychiatric but created by our most common domestic arrangement. This was confirmed by all the women she met with who, she said, hadn't stopped desiring but who had merely stopped wanting or had trouble wanting their partners. Yes, she agreed, there was this tangle in psychiatry's reasoning. She dwelled for a minute on the way our dreams and promises of forever seemed inevitably at odds with our sexual beings. There is an element of sadness, she said, when I think about the women I see, when I think about the couples I know, when I think about myself personally. She let out a sigh, or something akin to a sigh, a wordless note of grieving in a lower octave. So I think I'll stop there. I'd love to hear your questions, comments, anything in between. And I think there's a microphone that'll sort of make the circuit. So yes. But wait for the microphone just so that everyone else can hear.
Thank you. When the female subjects were told that their responses were their emotional responses or their intellectual responses were different from the physiology. How did they respond to that?
Good question, and I don't know the answer. So I, in research like this, you're my guess is, and it's a pretty, I'm almost certain of this, you wouldn't be allowed without a special kind of approval from the university, from the research university, to go back to those subjects a second time. So you'd have to design your study to have that kind of qualitative interview after the fact. So I don't think that information exists. It's a great question. The conversation with Meredith Shivers goes on. I'm going to raise that with her tonight or tomorrow morning. We'll find out. Yes.
When you were mentioning about the thrusting design.
The thrusting arrow,
and
yes.
You talked about the circle.
Yeah.
You mentioned something about the female circle succumbing to some political nature. You use that term. I don't know if you meant to use that term, but what did you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was sort of speeding right past a lot of complexity there. So I think there are three reasons I can give you, and probably more, for that shift from arrow as paradigm to circle as paradigm. One really would be the merging of the political and the aesthetic, right? This looks phallic. It is linear, often associated with males and patriarchy. And I think for purely that reason alone, there was a wish to reconceptualize through a more female lens, which seems, at least at first sort of thought, like a healthy impulse, the right impulse. I'm not sure ultimately that it is. The second issue that gets entangled with that is, and that is behind, I think, some of this move toward conceptualizing female desire as more receptive, as slower, as almost passive in some senses, is the sort of the race to find a female Viagra on the drug company's part. And so there's a resistance to, or a wariness of, that sort of pharmaceutical drive, and a wish on some people's part to kind of say, hey, female desire doesn't have to be instantaneous. Don't feel like you're disordered or unhealthy if it's not. Don't rush to buy what the pharmaceutical companies are, once they discover the drug, going to try to sell you. So those two things are at issue. And then I'll add a third, which I think is perhaps the most powerful. So, be honest, at least in your own minds, any of you who, like me, have been to couples counseling, the toughest thing, and the thing that couples counselors are least willing to acknowledge, is that reinstilling lust is not, it's just not easy, right? I mean, and I loved the few counselors who were really candid with me would say, you can talk about having a healthy relationship, you can get to a healthier relationship, you can bring emotional intimacy back into the relationship, but the emotional intimacy is not going to ignite, in most cases, and not all, but in most cases, that is not going to ignite the fiery desire that once, you know, characterized that relationship. And in a way, if you think about it, if you think past that mantra of, if only we were emotionally healthier, we'd, you know, be leaping at each other physically all the time. If you can think past that, it makes perfect sense. When we were, for the most part, most passionate about each other was when we knew each other least well, right? It was on the fifth date or the third date or the seventh date, or maybe we had to get to know each other a little bit, fair enough, to figure out what really worked in bed. But we kind of got there, and if you communicated, and communication's good, I'm not speaking at all against communication, but in any case, you get my point. Uncertainty was a part, probably, for getting to that level of lust. So it's really hard to get back to, and to circle back to this question, I think therapists have found something very comforting in the idea that desire takes time, is slow, is, you know, receptive and all of that, because of course it lowers the bar, and it creates a standard that's somewhat attainable, as opposed to that spontaneous seeming surge that is difficult to create in a therapy session or a therapy year. Anyway, those would be three reasons. That was a lot on the line in the circle. Okay, yeah.
So speaking of shifts to big O paradigms, I teach and study a practice called orgasmic meditation. It's a partnered practice that plugs me into my orgasm every day. And the paradigm shifts that created in my life are, you know, kind of boundless. And I guess my question is, like, what will it take? What do you see as a paradigm shift necessary such that the stuffy economists and Jeffrey Sachs aren't looking at you as though it were something weird or frivolous to study? Women's desire, women's sexuality. What do you see as the link between that kind of very receptive paradigm that you were just talking about and, you know, the social influences that are creating that?
Right. So, you know, we have a kind of split society. I mean, on the one hand, it seems sexually saturated, sexually liberated. On the other, I think still uneasy, and two levels of uneasiness worth talking about in response to your question. So one is just we're uneasy enough that the kind of research that Meredith does, she had to flee back to Canada in order to do. I mean, she started at Northwestern. The Washington Times got a hold of her research, ran a full mocking article about it, and it looked like she was going to be the next. I think it was Senator Proxmire who had sort of the most idiotic research award every year, and it looked like she was going to be next. So she realized this was not a place where, not, you know, where she could dependably get funding. And indeed, you know, I was per capita, there are so many more scientists looking at these questions in Canada than there are in the States. So I was constantly flying off to Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, and never did I go to, you know, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, or, you know, the like universities. So that is telling, I think, about an overall discomfort. And then I think, you know, with women's desire, it's so tricky because I think it's easy to think of us as, again, living in a society that's well beyond the old fears. We are not living in a Victorian age. And yet, you know, so many examples that sort of warn about the subtler ways that messages are entirely different for women and men. So just one example of that came up as I followed and wrote about for a chapter, the search for the so-called female Viagra, which of course is not a Viagra. Viagra is pretty mechanical in its effects. The desire drug that's being developed is, you know, much more about getting inside the mind. But, you know, more than one drug company had conversations that went like this. What if our results are too strong? Will the FDA turn us down because we'll be unleashing, you know, a world of nymphomaniacs? Now, that's, I mean, it is funny. And I laughed every time I heard this, but it wasn't an isolated conversation. I was hearing this again and again from people who were inside those rooms. And it just speaks so loudly to our divided sensibility, I think, when it comes to women's and men's sexuality. Yes.
I'm Susanna Mayer. I'm a sexologist in Philadelphia. I also run the Erotic Literary Salon, and I think you should come and read part of your book there because you'd have a great audience.
Happy to.
These are my followers. But I've done research, I've done focus groups, and your study, your book, is based on quantitative studies. There are qualitative studies out there and that show something very different. And the paradigm that you're talking about has all different circles and whatever, and if a female goes, I don't follow any of those, I clearly have a problem, I go by what is called a personal paradigm, and I'm not the only one that does that. There are other scientists out there, because my feeling is what turns me on and how it, my path is different than her path and is different than her path. And if we all have different ones, but we all feel satisfied afterwards, and they don't always end in orgasms to be satisfied, then there's no issue. There's no dysfunction. And so that people who come to me and self-define as low libido, sitting in my office, I go, who told you? Well, my husband wants it more than I do. And that's right. Unfortunately what happens.
Yeah, so a couple things I think I should point out. You know, I think there was an inherent problem in taking on a book like this, and or several. One was that I would be generalizing and creating overarching answers for sexuality, which has infinite, literally infinite variations. I'm going to rely on my last book, in a sense, to answer that, because The Other Side of Desire is actually all about our human variations. So I endorse what you're saying, and there's a book to, you know, stand for that. On the other hand, I felt like in this book that I was wrestling with a kind of depth of assumption and what seemed to be increasingly, as I spent time in this world, inaccurate assumption, and kept running up against a similar set, a like set of perceptual problems and lessons, really stark lessons in how perception can be profoundly affected by our preconceptions, even the perceptions of apparently careful scientists. And so in taking that on, I suppose I had to deal with some common denominators, I hope not some pat truths. I don't mean to be offering the big capital T and truth answer to the question posed on the cover of the book at all. But I do mean to be pushing against some accepted, widely absorbed conventional wisdom that I think is really suspect. Are you hearing this in the back? So it's the idea is if we were willing to conceptualize marriage as non-monogamous, marriages would be a lot healthier and last a lot longer. And the funny thing is after 8 years of sort of progressively thinking along these lines, I still feel a twinge of like fear, uneasiness, something in between fear and uneasiness about that idea. Like it's going to take a lot for me, and I don't know about the rest of you, and I certainly don't know about our society, to let go. Who I know, sure. Yeah. No, I have no doubt. And I should say I'll answer more questions in a sec. There's a fascinating caveat to a study that I've talked about a lot. So the pair of studies is 2,500 couples, pretty big number, and it tracks their desire over years. So the desire starts out for men and women about the same place, debunking any idea that women are less libidinous. Male desire declines kind of gradually. Female desire over time kind of plummets. But here's the curious caveat. Couples that don't live together don't have such a decline at all. So it's just something to think about. Anyway, so other questions or thoughts? Yeah. Yes. But you might need a microphone in the back there.
When you were talking about the research at the very beginning, you mentioned something that you would come back to, which was that the only images that didn't cause arousal were the men alone. So I just wanted you to expand on that.
I wish you'd forgotten that. Okay. So, yes, that is true. So to review, women alone, men with women with women, bonobos, and the only images, the only scenes, because they were videos, that weren't physically arousing to the women were the men alone. And after further research, and then combining it with findings out of other labs, here's the issue. The non-erect man just isn't doing much. So he was great. I mean, he looked good, let me tell you. I mean, I'd be happy to have that back, those abs, you know, those arms. But there it is. He was strolling along this really romantic beach, getting the picture. And it wasn't like, I mean, it wasn't like he wasn't well endowed. It just wasn't happening at that moment. And something about that just sort of killed it. Which could lead us into a whole other conversation about why. There's a lot of interesting theory and experimentation about why. But that was, that seemed to be the point of difference. Yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you. Daniel, going back to the exchange that you had before with this woman down closer to the front, and you were talking about, she was talking about how you, your work appears to be well-rooted in science. You're tracking the science. There was some discussion about quantitative versus qualitative, but nonetheless, you pushed really hard to understand the science of this. I'm wondering, while you're doing that, are you keeping an eye, as you do so, on, I guess, the culture in a more general sense, and I'm thinking maybe art in particular, and to make this even more specific to the paper that you do a lot of work in for, which is the New York Times, I find myself very intrigued by the Modern Love column on Sundays, and I find that over maybe 7 years of reading that through personal stories, I've come to understand what it is that you're doing on the science side. And I'm just curious if you, you know, if you're conscious in trying to bring those two realms together.
Definitely conscious of trying to bring the realms of culture and science together, but I'm not a faithful reader of the Modern Love column, so I can't comment. If you can put together a study of evolution of the Modern Love column, that would be great. But no, I'm very, very aware, thinking about the way our culture may or may not be changing. I often think changing less than we might think. There was, and I don't know if, you know, for those of you who read the New York Times on Sundays, there was a front page story 10 days ago about college sexuality, and it focused really on the phrase hookup, right? And it, to me, this was an article that the Times put a lot of resources in and could have been great, but there's a real Achilles heel to it, which is that the phrase hookup, as I know well from my 19-year-old son and about to be 21-year-old daughter, has a many different meanings. So to talk about the quickness within with which, you know, young women are hooking up, if that means making out, well, that's not really documenting a great change since, you know, any time really. So we're left, I wish there were some better research about how things are changing. But that may take, you know, 10 or more years. One interesting place to look is how much pornography is being watched by younger women. And there's some slight evidence that more is being watched over time, that the gap between male and female viewing is narrowing. But it's still, you know, more, there's, and that would be easy to get. And I don't, I actually spent a lot of time on the phone with Nielsen, you know, the tracking company, trying to really nail that down. And I think they finally either got sick of me or they just decided, we do not want to be quoted in this book. Let's let's leave that alone. Anyone else? Yeah.
Are there any in-depth studies of women seem to be sold on this business of a meeting of the bodies instead of meeting of the minds. Without a meeting of the minds, the meeting of the body is nothing.
Well, see, you're kind of proving my point. As a man, you're flipping every expectation around and longing for the meeting of the minds. So great. Again, none of what I'm saying is to diminish the importance of the meeting of the minds and the meeting of, you know, an emotional sort of truth. An emotional bonding. It is to try to some degree, to separate those things out so we can look at sexuality a little bit more candidly. Because I think that the idea that women's sexuality is all in the mind and men's sexuality is all in the groin, I mean, I just don't know where that gets us. I think that's an that's a one of those paradigms that we kind of need to let go of, and that after all, you know, like with so many of these paradigms I've been talking about, is so nice for me. I mean, it's so great as a guy to think that women are more into bonding, because for obvious reasons, right? And it's so nice for society to think that, because it just means we can rely on the social backbone provided by women. But, yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you for the adventures of women's desires. So my takeaway is that turning this misconception around, the women's desire is actually greater than men's. It's just they don't like the sexist on the menu. Oh, leave the comment.
Well, this raises a question that just so complicates things, that what sex is on the menu is a good question. How that, you know, that might bring us back to orgasmic meditation. By the way, I took a lot of detours that aren't in this book, and one of them was with a disciple and teacher of orgasmic meditation. But I'll let you take over and explain to everyone what OM is. I mean, I don't know about more, right? Because after all, in the end, and this gets back to that idea of quixotic searches and how wonderful they are, really. I mean, we can't cross that subjective divide. In the end, you and I can't really compare our levels of desire as two men, and perhaps all the more we can't quantitatively do that, you know, across the gender divide. I would certainly say there is no evidence to say that women's libidos are less than men's libidos. None whatsoever. And the evidence that's offered, and it will be offered, and it's offered by evolutionary psychologists when they respond to me, is based on two things that simply cannot serve as proof. Primarily, they're based on prevalence. Okay, so if women in Kansas City and women in a Palestinian village are both evince something of the same sexual pattern, and if modesty is prized more for women than for men in those two settings and, you know, 10 others, then it is taken by evolutionary psychologists as proof that that is genetically scripted into our beings. That simply cannot be so. And especially, and I'm not kidding you about the Palestinian village, that's in there, 1993, the paper that forms this thesis. Now, you cannot take one of the world's most repressed female populations and use it as evidence that women are naturally scripted to be more sexually modest than men. It just doesn't work. So that's number one. I mean, prevalence patterns, current patterns, do not prove prehistoric genetic codes, okay? And the second interesting thing that comes up is, you know, this idea that men are more prone to express, and that's the key thing here, express a greater desire for casual sex. Well, two things debunk that, and again, kind of go to this larger discussion we're having. One is there's great studies they talk about in the book that kind of strip away societal condemnations and thus get right to a sort of more direct vision of desire. And sure enough, desire for casual sex for women climbs right up once you strip away those issues. And the second thing, and this is fascinating, is that it sounds a little strange, but I think it's pretty revealing. So the UN does these female empowerment indices and looks at, you know, women in government, women's education levels, women's economic levels, et cetera. And a really interesting researcher at the University of Wisconsin took, you know, compiled a meta-analysis of involving, in the end, thousands of subjects and looked at rates of casual sex, rates of masturbation, et cetera, and then cross-correlated that with female empowerment. And sure enough, they track really closely, again suggesting that the patterns we see may be very much about the cultural constraints or cultural expectations, cultural realities that we live under. Anyway, thank you so much for being here. I loved having this conversation with you, and I hope you'll continue the conversation with each other.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.